The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa CIB. Tune in to the Absa Insight Series podcast and gain a better understanding of the non-bank financial institution sector. That's African Nacity. Absa is an authorised FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show this evening. Liz Truss, the new British Prime Minister, has thrown away the Conservative Party rulebook in the UK and is going to be borrowing billions and billions of pounds. She's cutting tax rates. She's going to make the rich richer, the poorer fed up. Interesting dynamics in the first, they called it a mini budget, but it turned into a maxi budget of extraordinary Thatcherite sort of moves in terms of that country's finances. An astonishing hitting the ground running mini budget in the first official week of work. Of course, that was delayed because of the death of Queen Elizabeth II, but now they're quite firmly back in the saddle, and boy, it's going to be interesting. Will this drive inflation? Will this destabilize the world's sixth biggest economy? Or will it pull it right? I simply don't know the answer to that question, but I have experts and guests and people with wisdom and insight who will be able to elucidate. And on to elucidate. That's a big word, isn't it? It is, George. It's one of the words on a pack of cards that you can buy on takealot.com, which have been created by a group of 10-year-olds from a Cape Town school. And they are selling them on Take A Lot. They've registered their business with SIPS, and they came and joined me in studio on Wednesday evening and made a very, very big impression. So in our best bits between 7 and 8, you'll hear from them as they take you through the business and the idea and the origins and just how you, as an adult, can help the young people in your life just think a little bit differently about how they understand the world. It's a wonderful project from a loving dad to his daughter, who then got her mates involved. And they've got shareholders and all sorts of things. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. We're going to talk to a milliner this evening. I told you we'd talk to a milliner. If you know what a milliner is, send me a WhatsApp. And I'd be curious to see how many different versions of milliner we get. Or maybe don't do that. I've got an idea for that. Don't mess with it, George. Don't mess with my ideas. We'll play the Brutal Biz Quiz later on. Tato Mashiko at Sundown Private Wealth will join us. We'll also chat to Paul Raffaele. Now, our big idea this evening in terms of looking at a big issue in the news, and that is elections and voting. Should we, like Australia, make voting compulsory? And do you have a right as an employer to insist that the people who come and work for you are registered to vote and on voting day actually go and vote? They can spoil their ballot if they choose to. They can vote for whichever party they like. But do you have the right to insist? It's a serious question, actually, and I don't know the answer to it. I have an instinct on it. I don't know. We'll talk about that later here on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Three big ratings agencies determine the world's view on the creditworthiness of economies all over the world. So you've got these big three ratings agencies, 200 economies in the world, and the ratings agencies provide regular credit ratings on many of them. You've got to pay Moody's, Standard & Poor's and Fitch to do the job, and they don't have to listen to your excuses and your reasons. They deliver, hopefully, an objective assessment. Between S&P and Moody's, they do 80% of the world's international ratings. It's a very concentrated industry. Sovereign Africa Ratings came into being, and it got its license in March this year. But it emerged from the 54th session of the Conference of African Ministers of Finance, Planning and Economic Development earlier this year. The logic being that the big global ratings agencies simply don't understand African economies. The big three ratings agencies have all got South Africa as being on sub-investment grade, and that has been since just before and during COVID. Now comes Sovereign Africa Ratings and says, no. South Africa, in fact, is investment grade. Dr. Sifiso Falala is the founder of Sovereign Africa Ratings. And Dr. Falala, welcome to The Money Show. How do you approach the ratings process differently to the big global players to have such a markedly different perspective?
How's it, Bruce? We look at it in terms of the extensive number of attributes that go into arriving at a conclusion. As you know, a lot of macroeconomic variables do come into calculations, but there are other developmental indices. For instance, corruption, legislation, and some other facets that might be regarded as relatively subjective in nature. So our methodology involves no less than 82 individual attributes, all of which feed into different pillars such as macroeconomics, socio-political situation, governance. And we didn't start out, obviously, with the result. When we did the calculations, we started out with a model that best fits the situation in terms of the structure of the economy. And I think on the basis of the calculation that we use and the model that we rely on, we seem to have come up with a markedly different outcome to the one of the tried and trusted agencies, so to speak.
I'm curious, do you and your team members have experience in these international ratings agencies?
We obviously have experience in, we have team members that have experience in doing economic modeling and econometric modeling, and some individuals within the team, like the analysts, that have experience within the ratings agency space. And we were very careful, given the step we were undertaking, to put together a team that had the capacity to produce results that have economic validity, but also are meaningful as far as the fiscus and the financial adjustments that need to be made are concerned.
Because it's a big difference. I mean, the big three ratings agencies have got South Africa two or three notches below investment grade, and you've got South Africa as being investment grade. Is your business model like the other agencies in the country, that you pay your, the government pays you to rate them, and they just have to accept whatever it is that you say, as they do to Fitch and S&P and Moody's?
Yeah, so this is what they do. In our case, the current rating is unsolicited, which means that it is not funded by the issuer. In this case, it is not funded by the South African government. It is funded by ourselves as a ratings agency, this being our very first rating as a business since we got our license earlier this year. And you would understand, of course, that there's potential conflict of interest if an agency is funded by the very entity that they are rating. In our case, we are not funded by the South African government, and our quantitative analysis and all the data that we've looked at is the reason why we've ended up with the output that we were able to launch and present this afternoon.
But you've got highly specialized and talented people. They're expensive. You've spent a lot of time doing this. How do you get funded?
The funding, globally, it is the issuer, and you would know that the credit ratings agencies, since the financial crisis, have been on the spotlight. And one of the issues discussed, especially by the European Commission under the auspices of the European Parliament, one of the issues discussed was whether or not investors should not pay for the ratings as opposed to the issuer. Because at the end of the day, what we saw was the issuer was actually shooting themselves in the foot. Our model is based on the fact that eventually there will emerge an internationally recommended standard practice, whether it is based on the issuers or it is based on investors or some sort of subscription model or a hybrid model. It will emerge at some point which model is best preferred. We are very concerned about conflict of interest as a business, and at this point we are having discussions about the potential for subscription to the detailed reports that we are going to be producing
because another perspective is critical, especially a homegrown perspective, and one that brings a nuance to the sort of reporting that doesn't exist in the big international ratings agencies. The problem here, though, is the vast majority of investment dollars may be skeptical of a reading such as yours that is so markedly different from the status quo. Are you worried about that?
Not at all. We expect that there will be a concern because the global financial system is exactly that, a global financial system. It operates on the basis of certain rules, computer equations where you input the rating and then certain securities come up and others, you know, go down and so on and so forth. What we believe in as a business, particularly coming from a developing economy, is the sustainability of ratings and the sustainability of the impact of the ratings on the sovereigns in particular that they rate. And we do believe that there will be a number of sovereigns and subscribers that can work with us. In the longer term, we believe that, you know, fiscal performance and potentially a macroeconomic performance and indices will bear us out in terms of the reliability of our instruments. And as you would know, that even those that depend, that are hardwired to rely completely on the three major agencies, they have questions about them, those agencies. In Europe, in fact, post 2011, it was even suggested that there should be a European rating agency and that, in fact, some of the issuers should do their own verification and risk analysis. So the topic under discussion is really about whether South Africa is ready to look at its own economy, its own risk exposure differently. And we are here to provide a different perspective.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Sifiso Falala, founder at Sovereign Africa Ratings. I mean, is it time? I mean, is it a different approach? It's so markedly different. That's what I worry about in terms of credibility. If you're a dollar investor, do you go to Fitch and Moody's, who you've trusted for years, or do you go to the new guys who say, no, 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 everything's fine? And then you talk to South Africans, and we are our own worst PR machine, of course. And they'll say, well, it's a bit like winning a beauty pageant and discovering that your mum and dad were the judges. And I worry a little bit, but we'll see. Dr. Sifiso Falala, good luck with it. Thank you very much indeed.
WhatsApp Bruce
on 072-702-1702.
It's day whatever. I've lost count. How many days of load shedding have we had? There are 265 days so far this year. We've had about 110 days of load shedding. Eskom promised us yesterday that they would go to stage 5 till tomorrow morning and they would change it, and we'll see. But people are frustrated. People are tired. People are enormously bored of being lied to by a government that has let them down for the last 15 years. And there's only one solution to that problem, and that is going to the polls and voting. But voting has become less and less popular because people have become more and more disillusioned about the efficacy of their vote. So there is a question, and the question is, should voting be compulsory in South Africa? It's compulsory in Australia. You can go to jail for not voting. Once you're in that booth, you can do what you like. You can colour it in. You can draw red noses on all of the politicians. You can do whatever you like, but you have to vote. Could you compel your staff in a South African company to register and to vote? I'm not sure. Voting is a powerful statement. It's a really important thing. And not voting can be as powerful as voting. Paul Raffaele disagrees. He is the co-founder and director at Nomu Brands. And you had a staff meeting yesterday and you put this to your staff and you said, guys, you know, how do you feel about the state of the nation? How do you feel about where you are? How do you feel about working in a factory where the electricity goes off every 3 hours or whatever it is at the moment? And it was, must have been quite an interesting meeting, Paul.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah, thank you very much for having me, firstly. It was an interesting meeting, but it wasn't one that just kind of happened on its own. We engage on an ongoing basis with our staff all the time, talking to them about the real things that affect them, whether it's the cost of oil, petrol, the fact that their children are at risk coming to and from work, whether or not maybe they'll be on an operating table and a generator will fail. These things needed to be made more real, and I think they have been real for them for some time. We put it to them that it was worth understanding that there's a difference between blaming Eskom and blaming the people that have been in charge of Eskom for a while. And I may be at fault for having put a bit too much of myself personally into the discussion, but I felt it needed to be had. And I was just thrilled by, you know, how positive the response was. They came back unanimously in an agreement that the one thing, the one positive thing, not punitive, not destructive, the one positive thing we could do is do something with our vote. And Voter apathy is a big issue in this country. That's a personal bugbear of mine. And for a lot of our staff over the years, I've worked hard to kind of get them more mobilized. But it's possible that load shedding is the thing that's just pushed them all over the edge now. And I went to them and I said, I don't want to force you. I want this to be a unanimous decision. I want you all to feel empowered to tell me I'm wrong. And there wasn't a single dissenting voice out of 60-odd employees. Sorry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there used to be an old rule at a dinner party. You never spoke about religion, sex, and politics. I'd hate to go to one of those dinner parties. It'd be incredibly dull. But those are topics that are pretty taboo in the workplace, particularly politics, and particularly when you've got a boss standing in front of staff and saying, guys, now I want you all to go and vote. And I think you've even pushed it as far as saying, you know, if we're going to hire people in the future, they need to show that they're registered to vote. They need to prove that they are as serious about democracy as we are.
It is true. I think it's important, if you're looking for soundbites here, I mean, I think we want to be less punitive about it and more positive. There is no element of discrimination at work in what we're thinking about here. It's not like we're going to, you know, force them to vote in any particular direction. From that point of view, we've been quite open. It's quite agnostic. But we do want to openly communicate that as a company, we view the democratic process as something precious and important and valid. And if you wish to be a part of this company that I still maintain is a very positive brand, it's a very positive voice in South Africa. And if you want to be a part of what we do on a day-to-day basis, understand that the people here now, the people that you're joining, they've made a commitment to basically push in this direction. You know, you get registered, it's not going to hurt.
My producers tell me I've got a voice note. So just pause for a moment, because at the beginning of the show, I said, can you force people who come and work for you to register to vote? And I think we've got a voice note from a lawyer.
Hi, I'm Michael Bagram, a Labour lawyer. I understand the need to ask people to vote, but to force people to vote is both unconstitutional and completely wrong. It doesn't make any sense at all. To make it a condition of employment is downright silly.
Oh, okay, you've been told.
Well,
I mean, that's interesting. That's a lawyer's perspective, Labour lawyer's perspective, Paul.
May I respond?
Can't force people. Please do.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Bagram, with respect, I'd like you to perhaps listen more carefully. We are not discriminating against people. We are asking them to make a decision for themselves. We are certainly not making it a fireable offence not to vote. We are trying to positively encourage people to participate in a process. We do not guide them or take any interest in guiding their political choices
said is, we have made registration to vote a future requirement of employment at NOMA. And Michael Bagram says that's illegal.
Well, registration to vote, if this is a battle worth having, I think I'm prepared to have it then. I'm not going to get into the letter of the law. The reality is I think we're past the point where voter apathy is something that can simply be accepted. I would like to think that we treasure certain things, including our democratic values and our democratic opportunities. And I'm at a point now where I simply need to know that the people who are around me understand that.
This is a lovely debate, Paul, but what about the right to not vote? I mean, I've got every right to not vote. I've got every right to express my displeasure with the state of the nation by not registering and sitting at home and having the day off because it's a public holiday.
Well, I was also going to add that as part of this, we have offered our staff an additional day's leave above a full paid day's leave in addition to what they currently receive. To ensure that's a guarantee from our side. That is our commitment to it. We are trying to, in fact, I'll say it again, we're agnostic in the view of who you vote for. We're not going to force anyone to vote. We simply want them to register.
Think about the process and empower themselves to make a choice. Paul, look, it's a really interesting idea. Co-founder and director at Nomu Brands. And this idea that we have as a society become apathetic. I think most societies in most parts of the world have been quite apathetic about democracy and about the way it's not working for them. The Australians take no prisoners they take lots of prisoners on this, actually, because if you don't vote, you get into trouble. You can go to jail in Australia. Paul Raffetti, thought-provoking. Thank you very much indeed. Co-founder
Thank
and
you,
director
Bruce.
At Nomu Brands.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Tato Mashiko is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. Was it all Liz Truss's fault that markets went to hell in a handbasket today, Tato? Welcome to The Money Show.
Well, good evening, Bruce. It's not such a warm welcome this evening. Unfortunately, markets have taken quite a beating today overall, and we are now officially in bear market territory at a global market perspective. The S&P 500 down over 20%, the NASDAQ down over 30%. So, unfortunately, we just have to ride out the storm as best as we can.
Is it all the fault of Trussonomics today, or is this just part of the broader theme of fear, trepidation, and anxiety about a global recession?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. People are having to readjust their expectations for 2023 following the exceptionally hawkish comments by the Fed on Wednesday. And I think, sadly, a lot of market participants thought you would have somewhat of a shallow rate hiking cycle and were hoping for rates to start coming down probably in the second half of 2023. That, of course, is now firmly off the table. And, of course, rising probability of a recession globally is compounding matters. So people are re-looking at their crystal balls, and 2023 is looking a lot bleaker than they thought a week ago.
It's amazing how fast it changes, doesn't it? I mean, we've had more than a dozen central banks around the world look at interest rates this week, and everybody raised interest rates except the Turks, as they've been wont to do, going against the flow. The pound at its worst levels against the dollar in 37 years. The dollar is surging. It's coming at a huge cost to the rand, of course. And it's the reason why Netanyahu was so aggressive this week, was an attempt to try and shore up the rand relative to the value of the US dollar. We wonder if it'll work.
Well, we certainly hope that it will work, but erring on the side of caution is probably the best path of action for the Reserve Bank. And we saw that two members of the committee actually voted for 100 basis point hikes. So we'll have to see exactly what they do in their upcoming meeting. But I think, as you mentioned, with the pound reaching the 1.1 level with the dollar, and some people speculating that it might even breach parity, of course, there's a lot of fiscal concerns materializing. Larry Summers came out today saying that the UK government is behaving like an emerging market. And when one looks at what the new finance minister that side has unveiled in terms of lowering the highest tax bracket from 45% to 40%, nominally a good thing, but not when you're simultaneously looking to borrow £150 billion to subsidize electricity prices. And so, of course, the market is concerned, how exactly are they going to fund this? Well, of course, they're going to borrow a lot more. And that is classic emerging market behavior. But
UK bond rates spiked up. UK bond rates spiked up to over 4% today, which in our terms, we'll borrow money at 4%. Please, thank you very much. But by UK standards, that's very high. And this is this fear that this becomes what they call the magic money tree, the thing that David Cameron and subsequent prime ministers, Theresa May and Boris Johnson, have rejected the magic money tree theory of economics and trickle-down economics, which Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, her finance minister, are wedded to.
Indeed, they have obviously said they will not engage in what they call windfall profits. So they're not going to tax the oil and gas companies, which, to be honest, could afford to bear some taxes to cover the subsidies on electricity. So instead, they're going to lower taxes and increase borrowing. And this, we'll have to wait and see exactly how this pans out. But the thing with subsidies is they have a tendency to become sticky, especially when voters get used to subsidized electricity. You see that in a lot of countries that are oil exporters around the world. And so I think the market is rightfully concerned with the trajectory and the fiscal trajectory that the UK is heading on.
Thank you to Tsato Mashego, who's portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. The JSE lost 3% of its value today. We're at levels where we were at the beginning of the year. S&P 500 is down 30% so far this year. It's messy, messy, messy on the markets.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB. To revive Africa's growth ambitions, you need to understand the alternative finance market. Absa does. Gain a better understanding of the non-bank financial institution sector and tune into the Absa Insight Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We're going to be talking to Crystal Birch in just a moment, a milliner and a stylist in our Friday file. But first, On the next Money Show, Rachel Colisi, the co-founder of the Colisi Foundation, is joining us for Other People's Money, talking to us about her relationship with money and investing. Then the chair, he's on the board of Discovery Bank, Stafford Massey, reviews one of his favorite books for us, Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order, Why Nations Succeed or Fail, by Ray Dalio, prolific American writer. He's a big investor. Looking forward to the perspective of Mr. Massey on that next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
So are hats a thing? Do you wear a hat? George wears a beanie. That's not a hat. That's a beanie. It's a different thing. I've got my Davos hat. It's too warm to wear anywhere else other than in snowy conditions. But my goodness me, it's a lifesaver. And I don't care what anybody says. The abuse that I've taken for expressing my individuality by wearing this wonderful hat. And it's, I don't know what it's made of, but it's woolly and warm. And it's black with a broad brim. It keeps the snowflakes out of your eyes. I think it's eminently stylish. I took a lot of abuse in the last winter Davos, which was in 2020. It was fine, the hat, actually. Hope we go again in January 2023. And I'll wear my hat again. And also it makes you stand out. Makes you stand out. Makes Richard Quest jealous. Makes him shout across the road at you because now you're distinctive. You're not wearing beanies like George. Most people wear beanies. One of the big European insurance companies was giving away beanies. But hats are a thing, certainly there. But I don't know, are hats a thing here? The first half of the 20th century, they were mandatory for men and women. Gradually, they fell out of everyday fashion, although they're incredibly stylish in the right context. Not if you're a farmer or you spend time on the beach, because then you have to wear a hat. It's required. But do you wear hats as a fashion statement? Becky Cele wears a hat. The late Jabu Mabuza wore his little straw hats. He had lovely little hats. Crystal Birch is a milliner and a stylist. Now, Crystal Birch, is a milliner different to a hat maker?
Hello there.
Hello, Crystal. Is a milliner different to a hat maker? Do you make only women's hats or do you make all kinds of hats?
We make all kinds of hats. And a milliner is a hat maker. In the Victorian times, the milliner was only the person who blocked the hat. But the person who actually trimmed the hat was called the trimmer, and then the hatter, the milliner. And now, in modern times, it's just one term. Milliner and millinery is the art of hat making.
Are hats a thing?
Say again?
Are hats a thing?
Of course it is, just like shoes, bras, belts, pants.
No, but that's definitely
a thing.
Most women wear a bra and everyone wears shoes, but not everyone wears a hat. It's more of a statement. A hat is a thing where you want to, like, make a great statement. And not too many people walk around with them every day. Is it big enough to sustain you?
I think that is... That is quite subjective, because if you are in the sun, what do you wear?
Yeah, but you wear just like a floppy hat that you buy at Cape Union Mart. We talk about your zhuzhi hats, your fantastic, beautiful felt and woolen hats. These art forms that you create. Those are things
that you wear
to the races and to weddings. You don't sort of wear them out on the street with your, take your fedora and put it on your hat on your head like they did in the 1950s.
I do especially, and I think my clientele does. It's about educating people that a hat is not an old-fashioned, a vintage thing. It is not necessarily an intimidating accessory. It should be there to elevate your mood, express yourself, protect you from the sun. I think I would like to also change the narrative that everything should be, a hat should be so special that you can only wear it to a certain occasion. I think a hat should become more accessible. And the other reason also is that things are handmade. And to go back to the craft, how we're making it the same way we've been doing it for the past 400 years, and that they don't get imported and that they get made locally by local hands. And there's a story in our 86-year-old factory to be told.
Has your factory been making hats for 86 years, unbroken?
Yes. Yes, it used to be called Parisian Milliners, and it was established in 1936. It's now called the Hat Factory, and we are much smaller, making a bit more niche hats, but we still make the same way, same technique it's been done for the past 400 years, from uniform to theatre, to film, to fashion, to Cancer Association approved hats. Yes. So we've got quite a big variety. And then we've got the special occasions and the custom pieces. But we also have, you know, commercial collections that goes into stores and tells a story for every season.
Now, I've got the most beautiful hat. I was bragging about it earlier. It's black. It's made of some kind of fur. I don't know if it's rabbit or something. But it's beautiful and warm, but you can only wear it in the snow, which makes it completely impractical for when I'm in South Africa. It never gets cold enough here for me to wear that hat. I overheat. So what materials do you use in your millinery?
Trade. So in South Africa, because of the African sun, we use a lot of wheat straw, a lot of raffia, Panama, paper Panama, Ecuadorian Panama. We are now starting a new Ecuadorian Panama collection. And then we do 100% wool felt. We don't, unfortunately, have any rabbit fur felt, beaver felt, or kangaroo felt, which we are currently researching to see how sustainable these practices are and where what the traceability is of these fur felt. They are the best felts to use, and they do last a lifetime. So when it comes to sustainability, it's also about how long does the product last and what's the wear and tear on it, that people don't just buy one and just in quick, fast fashion just get rid of it. You know what I mean?
No, and it's a wonderful craft, Crystal. I'm delighted that you're keeping it alive. How many people have you got working for you? How many professionals do you have pressing out the hats and trimming the hats and sewing up the hats and creating them?
We have three blockers and stiffeners, and we've got 15 women on the floor between machinists, trimmers, and milliners and cutters. One hat will go through about 12 to 15 people's hands. We used to be 38 before lockdown started, and we've gone much smaller and more dynamic. And also our team, I've got three staff members that's been in the industry for 50 years, so I've had quite an aged workforce that also retired during lockdown, and now we're a smaller crew, a team that actually is from quite young to about 78 years old.
Well, that's wonderful, Crystal. Thank you for sharing with us this evening. Crystal Birch this evening is a hat maker. Her company is called The Hat Factory. What a lovely tale. So easy start for you this evening if you've been paying attention, as I hope you have, because you know on a Friday night you need to be taking notes, writing down things in your notebook or making notes in your phone. I don't care where you make your notes. First question in tonight's Brutal Biz quiz on 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. First question, what does a milliner make? George is looking confused. He's not taking notes. We'll have to have a word in a moment.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA CIB. Tune into the APSA Insight Series podcast and get a better understanding of the non-bank financial institution sector. That's African Asset. APSA is an authorized FSP. Our lines are open on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. What does a milliner make? Imtiaz in Sandton.
Bruce, that will be hats.
Absolutely. The clue was in the interview. Well, the answer, not even a clue. The answer was in the interview just before. And we just spoke to Crystal Birch, who is the owner of the Hat Factory. The company that is the biggest exporter of avocados in the world originates from South Africa. But it's far bigger than South Africa nowadays. It grows avocados in something like 15 different territories. It supplies to 36 countries, 365 days a year. It's owned by the Hans Smirensky Trust. What is the name of the world's biggest producer of avocados, Imtiaz?
Is it ZZ2?
I knew you were going to say that, and I'm disappointed that you said that, because it's wrong. They're very good at producing avocados. Thank you, MTS. They're very good at avocados, by the way, at ZZ2. But if you know the other company, Limpopo-based company, competitor, started by Hans Marinsky. The company's named after an estate that Hans Marinsky bought in Limpopo before it was called Limpopo, Northern Transvaal, probably, or Eastern Transvaal, Northeastern Transvaal in those days. And the Marinsky Reef is named after Hans Marinsky. They've got huge forestry businesses. Nobody can ever go at this. And I want to get the CEO of this company is called Alk Brandt, and he is based in the UK, but he's taken this particular business global in the most impressive way. ZZ2 are impressive in their own way. They are, at the moment, in this, they're called the cherry window, the only producers of fresh cherries in the world, ZZ2 are. But this other company is the world's biggest producer of avocados. And you guys are all chicken. And it also reveals to me that you've not read my book. So you're all in the naughty corner, I'm afraid. The company's called Westphalia. Oh, yes, I knew that, you say to yourself. Well, that's no good, because you've not shared your great wisdom with us. You haven't told us about Westphalia. Yep, the world's biggest avocado producer. The Swiss tennis player who will play their last match of their career. Half Swiss, half South African. He's like his mum is South African. His dad was Swiss. And this tennis player is our most successful tennis export ever. We don't own him one little bit, actually. So what is the name of the tennis player playing their last match of their career this evening? Mr. Teixeira was reporting on it in Eyewitness News. Let's talk to Mohadi. Producers, time. There we go. Mohadi. Mohadi.
Hi, Bruce.
Name the tennis player.
Rafael Nadal.
No, Mohadi. Rafael Nadal is not half South African. Rafael Nadal is playing with this guy, Andre. Who's Rafael Nadal playing tennis with this evening?
It can only be Roger the Federer.
Roger the Federer. Not Roger the Fedora, because a fedora is a kind of hat. And so, no, it's not Roger the Fedora. We're talking about hats this evening, but no. He's 41 years old. He's played more than 1,500 matches over 24 years. Sure, that's a lot. Yeah. That's a huge amount. Queen Victoria sent tins of what?
Your call has been placed on hold. Please wait.
If you don't want to play, just say so. Okay, I'll tell you the story because we're out of time anyway. Queen Victoria used to send tins of chocolate to British soldiers fighting in the South African War between 1899 and 1902. And this tin of chocolate has been opened and somebody took a bite out of a chocolate at some point in the last 100 years. Roundtree's chocolate. It was ordered by Queen Victoria, sent to British soldiers fighting in South Africa. And the Roundtrees were pacifists. I think they were Quakers. And they didn't want their brands associated with the war effort. So this box, which has been sold on auction in South Africa, when in the UK, sold for 9,000 rand. It's missing one piece of chocolate and was found in a box of junk in an attic. So here we've got this almost intact box of chocolates. Life is not a box of chocolates. Who said that? Run, Forrest, run. Forrest Gump said that. I'm the winner. I've beaten you. You guys were particularly poor this evening. I think you should be very ashamed of yourselves. In order to improve your understanding and joy of the world, you do need to listen to the best bits this evening. The 10-year-olds who joined me in studio on Wednesday evening were just remarkable. 10-year-olds building a business. If you're an adult with a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, an adult with somebody you would like to see get started in business, please listen to the best bits of The Money Show, because the opportunity of setting somebody up for life is just extraordinary.